Chapter 5. The Journal of Major George Washington. O Winter, Ruler of the Inverted Year. William Cowper, The Winter Evening. Lawrence Washington's death left vacant the office of adjutant of the Virginia Militia, a position that involved overseeing and inspecting militia companies throughout the colony. Though George Washington had received much military knowledge from his brother, so far he had no formal military training or any battlefield experience. What he lacked in terms of first-hand contact, he made up for in first-class ambition. Eager to establish a military career of his own, he actively sought his brother's old office. Colonial authorities could see that Virginia had grown too populous for one man to oversee all its militia companies. Instead of appointing a single officer to fill the vacancy, they split the office of adjutant into four positions, each supervising a different part of the colony. In February 1753, Governor Dinwiddie appointed George Washington adjutant of the Southern District of Virginia with the rank of major. The governor later reassigned him to the position he preferred, one much closer to home, adjutant of the Northern Neck. The position as adjutant opened up further opportunities for George Washington, just as he had hoped. In the early 1750s, French activity in the Ohio Valley became increasingly aggressive, and in the words of one observer, Governor Dinwiddie thought it high time to come to an éclaircissement. In other words, Dinwiddie decided that the British and French should reach some kind of mutual understanding about the frontier. Consequently, he wrote a letter to the French commandant. Writing the letter was the easy part. Putting it into the hands of the commandant hundreds of miles from Williamsburg would be more difficult. Washington volunteered for the mission. Leaving Williamsburg the last day of October 1753, he braved cold, wet, miserable conditions through the American wilderness over the next 2.5 months, but successfully delivered the message to the French commandant of the Ohio Valley and safely returned to Williamsburg, reaching the city on January 16, 1754. Aware the governor would expect a detailed account of his mission, Washington had kept a journal throughout his backwoods experience. Though he was only 21, his journal demonstrates remarkable maturity and considerable literary skill. It marks a significant advance over his earlier travel journals. His sense of responsibility partly accounts for the improvement. He understood the profound significance of this mission and the value of recording it in precise detail. His sense of audience contributes to its literary quality. Washington knew he would be presenting the journal to a well-educated and well-read British governor with excellent taste. Perhaps members of the governor's council would also read his manuscript journal, and maybe some of the lords of trade back in Britain. Washington's increasingly broad travel reading had helped him refine his prose style. It is difficult to read the clean, crisp prose of his journal and not think of Defoe's tour through Great Britain. Upon returning to Williamsburg, Washington delivered his manuscript journal to Governor Dinwiddie. Recognizing it as an insightful account of the relations between the English and French in America and a valuable source of information about the American frontier, the governor rushed the journal into print. Washington had little time, perhaps only a few days, to prepare the manuscript for publication. His prefatory remarks explain that he had no leisure to consult of a new and proper form to offer it in, or to correct or amend the diction of the old. He was being modest. Before his revisions, the narrative was fairly well polished. His last-minute changes quicken its pace, soften a few hasty judgments, and enhance the excitement. The work appeared under a straightforward title, The Journal of Major George Washington. Suddenly, Washington found himself a published author. The Journal of Major George Washington is the first of several works Washington wrote and published in his lifetime. Though he never had authorial ambitions, Washington understood that, with his increasing fame, what he wrote would need to be published. He accepted the role of author reluctantly, but he accepted it nonetheless. The Journal of Major George Washington captured the public imagination. Newspapers up and down the East Coast republished it serially. The Maryland Gazette, for one, reprinted it in March 1754. American editors and British publishers recognized the work as a crucial document in the emerging conflict between Great Britain and France. The Boston Gazette reprinted the journal from the Maryland Gazette. The following headnote prefaces the first installment in the Boston Gazette. The storm arising in the West, being the present topic of conversation, we think we cannot oblige our readers at this juncture with anything more entertaining than Major Washington's journal to Ohio, who was sent last fall by the governor of Virginia to the commandant of the French forces there. Thomas Jeffries, a London printer, engraver, and mapmaker who kept a weather eye out for geographical books published in America, also reprinted the Journal of Major George Washington, complete with a map of the Ohio Valley. Enjoying Washington's journal, one 18th-century reader commented, "The manliness of his style, correctness in detail, and solidity of judgment render it a very interesting performance." Literary historian Richard Beale Davis has praised its vivid description, use of dialogue, and briskly paced narrative. Though few others have considered the work's literary qualities, the Journal of Major George Washington deserves recognition as a major contribution to the history of colonial American travel writing. Revising his journal for publication, Washington had the opportunity to relive the experience and shape it for a wider audience, a readership beyond a small circle of colonial administrators. The narrative's first paragraph is headed October 31, 1753, the day Governor Dinwiddie commissioned him and the day Washington left Williamsburg. The next day he reached Fredericksburg, where he hired as his interpreter Jacob van Braam, a Dutch-born French teacher a few years older than him. Together, these two young men traveled to Alexandria, where they acquired some necessary supplies. They continued to Winchester, obtaining horses and additional baggage for their wilderness trek. Washington encapsulated all these activities within the opening paragraph of the Journal of Major George Washington. Before that paragraph ends, 2 weeks have passed, and the two men have reached Wills Creek, now Cumberland, Maryland. On Wednesday, November 14th, the day they arrived at Wills Creek, Washington hired Christopher Gist to lead them to Logstown. A surveyor, explorer, and Indian scout, Gist, now approaching 50, may have been more familiar with the Ohio Valley than any other American colonist alive. On behalf of the Ohio Company, he had already explored the valley as far west as the mouth of the Scioto River. Washington's journal contains little information about Gist, or for that matter any of the men who joined the expedition. The absence of personal details suggests he did not have time to elaborate. Washington was capable of incisive character sketches, as a letter he wrote a few years later verifies. This letter provides the single best pen portrait of Gist available. "He has had extensive dealings with the Indians, is in great esteem among them, well acquainted with their manners and customs, is indefatigable and patient. Most excellent qualities indeed where Indians are concerned. And for his capacity, honesty, and zeal, I dare venture to engage." Such description may be unnecessary to the journal. Washington did not need to develop the personal characteristics of Gist or the other backwoodsmen he hired at Wills Creek. He let their actions speak for themselves. Christopher Gist also kept a diary of their mission. Gist's diary does not contradict Washington's, but it does differ in terms of emphasis. Gist stressed certain episodes in his diary, Washington others. Each provides information the other omits. Not only does Gist's account help tell a fuller story, it also reveals the gaps in Washington's journal. Essentially, Gist's account shows what Washington omitted and inadvertently reveals Washington's literary skill. Read in the light of Gist's diary, the Journal of Major George Washington demonstrates how its author used his writing ability to present readers with a carefully crafted version of himself. Despite the miserable weather, they left Wills Creek the day after arriving. It took them another week to reach their next crucial destination. Washington did not use the journal as a forum for complaint. Rather, he simply related the adverse conditions as a matter of fact. The excessive rains and vast quantity of snow which had fallen prevented our reaching Mr. Fraser's, an Indian trader, at the mouth of Turtle Creek, on Monongahela till Thursday. By Mr. Fraser's, Washington meant the Indian trading post John Fraser had established on the Monongahela River at the mouth of Turtle Creek. Earlier that year, the French had forced Fraser from his other trading post, the one at Venango, which they commandeered as their local headquarters. Upon seeing the Monongahela, Washington realized they would have to unburden their horses and swim them across. The kind-hearted Fraser agreed to loan them a canoe to transport their baggage 10 miles to the forks of the Ohio River. Two men went in the canoe while Washington led the others on horseback across the freezing cold river. Reaching the Ohio before the canoe, Washington had the opportunity to take a good look around. He could see that this location was well situated for a fort. The journal beautifully captures his experience. The pace of the narrative slackens as its author describes a moment of calm and contemplation. An experienced surveyor and nascent military strategist, he pauses to ponder the land's commercial and military value. At this point, the journal presents a vivid self-portrait of its author, which has the quality of a tableau. 3 months shy of his 22nd birthday, Washington gazes westward into the wilderness and imagines what the continent will become. Visiting the location where the Ohio Company intended to erect a fort, near present-day Pittsburgh, Washington found it comparatively inadequate in both economic and strategic terms. The knowledge of military strategy he brought to bear as he analyzed both locations is extraordinary. Though he had gained some military knowledge in conversation with Lawrence, his brother's influence seems inadequate to explain Washington's deep perspective of the situation. To be sure, he had an intuitive grasp of military strategy, but intuition alone cannot explain the understanding he displayed on this, his first military mission. In the coming years, Washington would keep abreast of the latest military literature, but before this mission, he had read few, if any, recent books on the subject. Where did his military knowledge come from? By the time he had begun this journey, he was familiar with one or two military classics. A letter from William Fairfax asserts that Washington owned a copy of Julius Caesar's Commentaries. The figure of speech Caesar used just before crossing the Rubicon, "The die is cast," would become a favorite with Washington. Suetonius's History of the 12 Caesars, a work Fairfax had in his library at Belvoir, is the source of the saying. Fairfax was reasonably confident that Washington also owned a copy of Quintus Curtius's History of the Wars of Alexander the Great, though he could not say for sure. Why did Fairfax assume Washington owned a copy of Quintus Curtius? Apparently, young Washington could hardly stop talking about the exploits of both Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great. Other evidence confirms his knowledge of these two great military commanders. Redecorating Mount Vernon a few years later, he ordered busts of Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar to adorn his home. Washington also obtained several decorative prints illustrating Alexander's victories in battle. Quintus Curtius's History of the Wars of Alexander the Great could have taught Washington much about what makes a great leader. Relating the life of Alexander, Curtius faced a challenge. The climax, the death of Alexander's greatest enemy, the Persian king Darius, occurs less than halfway through the story. The remainder of Alexander's conquests as he proceeded east to India were not as difficult or dramatic as his fight against Darius's troops. What sustains the narrative is the force of Alexander's personality. Relating his exploits, Curtius shows the personal qualities a great leader requires: camaraderie, clemency, decisiveness, flexibility, a mind that enjoys wrestling with problems, practicality, resolution in the face of danger, self-control, a sense of efficiency, and a strong will. Despite his appreciation of Alexander's leadership qualities, Curtius's History of Alexander is not hagiography. Curtius identifies Alexander's faults as well as his virtues. During lulls between battles, Alexander would give in to his vices and fall into dissipation, and his temper sometimes got the better of him. Written as a narrative, not a practical manual, Caesar's commentaries nonetheless could be read as a military guide. It provides more useful detail about strategy than Curtius's History of Alexander. Caesar's story of his military exploits in Gaul emphasizes the importance of engineering, building bridges, constructing fortifications, erecting siege towers, making roads. Yet Caesar was a pragmatist. Good roads are important, but an army should only build them when they have the time. In the heat of combat, speed, stealth, and surprise are vital elements of success. Efficient communication is also essential. Furthermore, a commander needs to understand the mindset of his men. Sufficient provisions are necessary not only for assuring the welfare of the troops, but also for securing their loyalty. Courage is important. Discipline is more important. Soldiers should not let courage outstrip discipline. A commander must take several steps to understand the enemy, analyze its tactics, scrutinize its fortifications, and survey its territory. Flexibility is key. He must be willing to adjust his strategy to adapt to the enemy, the terrain, and the weather. As Washington scouted locations for a possible fort to defend against the French, he apparently did so by keeping the thought of Julius Caesar's Gallic exploits in mind. Besides giving him such practical military information, Caesar's commentaries also gave Washington another model for writing. John Seeley observes that the Journal of George Washington and the accounts of other diplomatic and military missions Washington undertook are neat and spare, as in Caesar's commentaries, taking their life from events, not style. Near the site where the Ohio Company planned to erect its fort lived Shingas, King of the Delawares, as Washington called him. To be precise, Shingas was a principal chief of the Unalechtigo tribe of the Delaware. Washington saw him as a useful ally and invited Shingas to accompany him to Logstown, one of the main Indian trading villages in the Ohio Valley. Shingas agreed. They reached Logstown late Saturday afternoon, November 24th. Or, as Washington phrased it in a more vivid yet no less accurate way, "We arrived between sunsetting and dark, the 25th day after I left Williamsburg." Washington quickly learned from John Davison, an Indian trader and interpreter working out of Logstown, that Tanakarison, the Seneca chief better known as Half King, was at his hunting cabin on Little Beaver Creek. Washington really needed to speak with him, but in his absence he spoke with Monacatoucha, the Oneida chief who acted as second in command at Logstown. Through Davison, Washington informed Mona Katucha of his mission to present a message to the French commandant and urged him to send for Half King. Aware of the importance of hospitality in Native American culture and wanting very much to foster their friendship, Washington invited Mona Katucha and other local leaders to his tent that evening. Waiting for Half King the next day, Washington took advantage of the extra time to collect useful military information about the land and the strength of the French forces. Once Half King finally arrived, Washington, speaking through Davison, invited him to his tent for a private conference. Relating this episode, Washington's journal reflects the seriousness and significance of their meeting. Half King was an influential figure who would play a crucial role in Washington's wilderness adventure. In September, Half King had led a group of Indians to the French fort at Presque Isle to warn the French commandant, Pierre-Paul de la Malgue, Sieur de Marin, against French expansion into the Ohio Valley. The title Sieur could mean gentleman or lord of the manor, but its usage was less rigid than the English terms sir or lord. Washington wished to know how the journey went and how Marin had received him. Recording Half King's response in his journal, Washington applied some fairly sophisticated narrative techniques. He used indirect discourse to report how Half King described the route to the French fort. "He told me that the nearest and levelest way was now impassable by reason of many large miry savannas, that we must be obliged to go by Venango, and should not get to the near fort under 5 or 6 nights' sleep, good traveling." Reporting how Marin received Half King, Washington continued using indirect discourse. Partway through the account, he switched to direct discourse to quote Half King's speech to Marin. Washington's use of direct discourse lends immediacy to the conference between Marin and Half King, giving it the quality of a flashback. The italic typeface of the published journal reinforces the shift in voice and time. After supplying what appears to be a word-for-word transcription, Washington qualified it, stating, "This, he said, was the substance of what he spoke to the general, who made this reply." Moran's speech to Half King follows. Presenting the speech in direct discourse, Washington brings the experience alive and effectively shows Moran's self-centered nature. The accuracy of Moran's speech is suspect, however. After all, it had gone through several interpretive filters before it reached the pages of Washington's journal. Washington was quoting translator John Davison, quoting Half King, quoting Marin, who likely delivered his original speech through a translator as well. Marin's speech makes him seem snobbish and superior, even haughty. He takes a deprecatory attitude toward the Native Americans, addressing Half King as "my child" and likening Indians to insects. "I am not afraid of flies or mosquitoes, for Indians are such as those." In this speech, Marin exaggerates the strength of the French forces, and in so doing, insults Half King's intelligence, saying he had as many troops as grains of sand on the beach. The most unusual part of Marin's speech, as Washington recorded it, is the part containing an inserted parenthetical adverb. "It is my land, and I will have it. Let who will stand up for or say against it. I'll buy and sell with the English," mockingly. "If people will be ruled by me, they may expect kindness, but not else." How did Half King express Moran's mocking tone? Though presenting a version of the speech, the journal provides no additional clues about its telling. Washington had several reasons for recording the speeches of Half King and Marin in direct discourse. His penchant for precision is one. The same quality that made him an expert surveyor compelled him to record his experiences as precisely as possible. Washington's transcription of these speeches also indicates the seriousness he brought to his mission. He understood that diplomatic exchanges could have vast repercussions. Failed communications could lead to war. A record of these speeches offered evidence of French and Indian attitudes toward one another. Literary reasons also motivated Washington to incorporate these speeches in his journal. Indian treaties, which typically incorporated numerous speeches, had already emerged as a popular form of literary entertainment in early American culture. The treaties between colonists and Native Americans reflected, as Lawrence Roth put it, the passion, the greed, and the love of life of hard-living men brought into close relationship without parallel conditions in the history of either race to guide its conduct. Contemporary readers, Washington included, found these diplomatic encounters fascinating. In his personal library, Washington had a copy of The Treaty Held with the Indians of the Six Nations at Lancaster in Pennsylvania, June 1744. This particular treaty had considerable literary and cultural appeal. Benjamin Franklin reprinted 200 copies of it for resale in Great Britain. Another American reader sent a copy to a friend on the Isle of Man, which he told him would provide some insight into the genius of those people we brutishly call savages. There's no telling precisely when Washington acquired his copy, but most likely he knew it before he undertook this mission. He clearly understood the rhetorical conventions of Native American diplomacy. By including Moran's speech in his narrative, Washington also established a point of comparison with his own speech to Half King and the other Indians, whom he addressed in council on Monday, November 26th. Washington recorded his own speech in direct discourse too. It begins, "Brothers, I have called you together in council by order of your brother, the governor of Virginia." In the journal, both Marin and Washington express their relationship with the Indians as a figurative kinship, whereas Marin uses the word child to address Half King, Washington uses brothers to address the members of Half King's council. Calling Half King his child, Marin indicates his sense of superiority. Washington alternatively demonstrates camaraderie and equality. When it came to the practice of diplomacy in colonial America, one of the biggest obstacles to negotiation involved the concept of time. The Native American attitude toward time was much more relaxed. Conversely, colonial Americans were more anxious to get things done as quickly as possible. Washington was no exception. His eagerness to finish his business partly stemmed from personal inclination, that it also reflected both his sense of duty and his practical nature. He was an army officer following orders, orders stipulating that he deliver his message to the French commandant with all possible dispatch. In addition, he knew that as winter approached, he risked dangerous weather every day he delayed. During their negotiations, Half King engaged in some classic stall tactics. Initially, Washington could not mask his impatience. The journal captures the tension arising from their disparate attitudes toward time. Ultimately, Washington relented, explaining that it was impossible to get off without affronting them in the most egregious manner. His behavior hints that he had learned much more from his rules of civility than the rules themselves. He also learned an outlook that let him generate new rules of behavior when the standard ones no longer applied. As Half King's delaying tactics continued, Washington adjusted his behavior accordingly. "I consented to stay, as I believed an offense offered at this crisis might be attended with greater ill consequence than another day's delay." On Friday, November 30th, Washington and his men, accompanied by Half King, an old Iroquois chief named White Thunder, and a young Seneca warrior known simply as the Hunter, set off for Venango, which they reached the following Tuesday, December 4th. John Fraser's old trading post was now flying French colors and serving as a regional French headquarters. Here, Washington met Philippe Thomas de Joncaire, Sieur de Chabert, who served as the chief Indian interpreter for the French. Wanting to deal with Captain Joncaire on his own terms, Washington kept him and Half-King separate as long as he could. Upon meeting Joncaire, Washington did not even mention he was traveling with Half-King. Joncaire informed Washington that he had command of the Ohio, but also that Washington would have to deal with his superior officer. Unbeknownst to Washington, Sieur de Marin, who had been Joncaire's superior, had died at Fort Lebeuf on October 29th. Jacques Le Gardeur, Sieur de Saint-Pierre, had succeeded Marin as commandant of the French forces in the Ohio country, and he was stationed at Fort Lebeuf. This disheartening piece of news meant that Washington still had several more days of cold, wet, weary travel ahead of him. For the time being, he tried to make the most of his encounter with Joncaire. He accepted the captain's invitation to join him and his men for dinner. Washington's account brings their decadence and dinner conversation alive. The wine, as they dosed themselves pretty plentifully with it, soon banished the restraint which at first appeared in their conversation, and gave a license to their tongues to reveal their sentiments more freely. Recording their conversation, Washington used indirect discourse, but nevertheless caught the tone and tenor of what the French said, down to the expletive they used. He wrote, "They told me that it was their absolute design to take possession of the Ohio, and by G, they would do it, for that although they were sensible the English could raise two men for their one, yet they knew their motions were too slow and dilatory to prevent any undertaking of theirs." Washington learned that the French understood the shortcomings of British military strategy, something he stored in his memory for later use. The more the French drank, the more Washington learned. He discovered how many men they had at each fort south of Lake Ontario, where all four of the French forts were located, and how they were provisioned. He also learned how long it took for additional troops and supplies to travel from Montreal. Washington hoped to leave Wednesday morning, December 5th, but excessive rain prevented his departure. The delay let Joncaire learn that Washington was traveling with Half-King. Eager to win over this Seneca chief, Joncaire became chummy with him. Expecting favors from the French, Half-King now refused to leave Venango. Thursday night, Washington left Davidson with Half-King to help him get going on Friday morning, but it took the combined efforts of Davison and Gist to roust Half-King and his men. Though the rain had let up, travel remained daunting. All the recent rain and snow made the rivers downright treacherous. The journal provides little detail about the next stage of their trip, but Gist recorded the conditions more fully. On Friday, they found Sugar Creek high and swift. They cut down some trees to create a makeshift bridge to transport their gear, but had to swim their horses across. Washington and Gist took the lead and crossed with their boots on. By Friday night, they had traveled only 5 miles past Venango. They made 25 miles on Saturday, but the strenuous effort took its toll. One horse could travel no further, and the others would perish without considerable time for recuperation. On Sunday, the 9th, they reached the big crossing and started constructing a raft, but the river was too fast and too deep. An alternate route took them through mire and swamps. They had another river to cross the next day. Happily, the hunter killed a bear, and its succulent meat helped fortify the men. Gist's diary supplies much information about the challenging terrain they crossed and the hardships they encountered. Instead of relating the treacherous conditions himself, Washington used his journal to describe the land's enormous agricultural potential. "We passed over much good land since we left Venango, and through several extensive and very rich meadows, one of which I believe was near 4 miles in length and considerably wide in some places." More than anything, Washington's journal sounds like colonial promotion literature as it boasts about the richness of the land. They did not reach Fort Lebeuf until after sunset on Tuesday, December 11th. Early the next morning, Washington met Le Gardeur de Saint-Pierre, the new French commandant, who had only arrived himself about a week earlier. Washington wrote a brief personal description. "He is an elderly gentleman and has much the air of a soldier." Though nowhere else in the journal does Washington supply such character descriptions, he does so here for one simple reason. No one in Virginia had any experience with Le Gardeur de Saint-Pierre. Washington provided a quick verbal sketch of the French commandant to let his readers picture him. Upon his arrival, Washington presented his commission to the commandant as well as the letter from Governor Dinwiddie. Before they could consider the documents, the French had to translate them. As their translators worked, their officers left Washington alone. A strategic error. With no one looking over his shoulder, he took the opportunity to measure Fort Lebeuf, study its construction, pace off the distance between the fort and the water, and count the number of dwellings, outbuildings, and canoes. Before the French reached a decision about Washington's commission, he had fully assessed the strengths and weaknesses of Fort Lebeuf. 2 days passed without a French decision, but with many inches of new snow. Washington grew wary about the return trip. Getting weaker by the day, the horses would not last much longer. He sent 3 men and all the horses back to Venango. He would follow in a canoe. Increasing his anxiety, the French continued to gain the Indians' favor, bribing Half King and the others in an effort to dissuade them from returning with him. On Friday night, he received word from the French in the form of a letter addressed to Governor Dinwiddie. This formal document, though lengthy, came down to one key sentence. "As to the summons you send me to retire, I do not think myself obliged to obey it." As far as the French were concerned, they had come to the Ohio Valley to stay. Le Gardeur de Saint-Pierre's letter reinforced the urgency of Washington's mission. Having now received official word regarding their intentions, Washington grew anxious to return to Williamsburg with all due haste. He prepared for his departure on Saturday the 15th. Le Gardeur de Saint-Pierre seemed helpful, but Washington recognized his duplicity. According to the journal, "The commandant ordered a plentiful store of liquor, provision, etc., to be put on board our canoe, and appeared to be extremely complaisant, though he was exerting every artifice which he could invent to set our own Indians at variance with us, to prevent their going till after our departure." Washington softened this statement when he revised his journal for publication. In the original version, instead of "exerting every artifice which he could invent," Le Gardeur de Saint-Pierre was "plotting every scheme that the devil and man could invent to set our Indians at variance with us." Omitting the proverbial expression as he revised the manuscript, Washington removed the comparison between the devil and the French commandant and made the account more literal, if less colorful. He stayed until the next morning, December 16th. The French were still plotting to keep the Indians there, but Half King relented, agreeing to leave with Washington. Half King, White Thunder, and the Hunter went in one canoe, Washington and Gist in another. The French manned 3 canoes to accompany them. Washington summarized the trip to Venango briefly. "We had a tedious and very fatiguing passage down the creek. Several times we had like to have staved against rocks, and many times were obliged all hands to get out and remain in the water half an hour or more, getting over the shoals. At one place, the ice had lodged and made it impassable by water. Therefore, we were obliged to carry our canoe across a neck of land a quarter of a mile over. Gist's account of this segment of the trip is much more detailed. He noted, for instance, that one canoe overturned, destroying the cargo and powder and shot of the French. Another day, a second canoe overturned. Gist wrote, "We had the pleasure of seeing the French overset and brandy and wine floating in the creek." Washington said nothing about either the French canoe accident or their loss of liquor. Unlike Gist, he took no pleasure in the misfortune of others, or if he did, he did not say so in either the manuscript journal or the published one. At Venango, which they reached on Saturday the 22nd, they met the rest of their men waiting with the horses. Having suffered an injury, White Thunder told Washington he would stay at Venango. Half King decided to stay with him. Washington disliked leaving them both with Joncaire, but he could do little to alter the situation. He cautioned Half King against Captain Joncaire's schemes. The hunter, ever trustworthy, agreed to continue with Washington. Though the figure of the noble savage would not emerge in American literature for decades, the hunter, in Washington's hands, becomes a crucial prototype. The horses were in such bad shape, Washington ordered most of the men to put packs on their backs and walk. He created a vivid self-portrait for the journal, explaining that he himself donned an Indian walking dress and walked together with the others for 3 days. The going was slow, and the cold and snow made their travel more treacherous. Anxious to deliver his message, Washington hurried ahead with Gist, leaving Von Braun in charge of horses and baggage. Gist expressed some uncertainty about Washington's decision, worrying that this young gentleman was unused to hiking such long distances. Gist's diary conveys his concern. Washington's journal contains no such uncertainty. Instead, the journal shows Washington going about his duties without hesitation. "I took my necessary papers, pulled off my clothes, and tied myself up in a match coat. Then, with gun in hand and pack at my back, in which were my papers and provisions, I set out with Mr. Gist, fitted in the same manner, on Wednesday the 26th. Depicting himself adorned in a match coat, Washington develops his self-portrait further. Though it derives from an Algonquin root word, the term match coat referred to European-made units of woolen cloth about 2 yards long, which were traded to the Indians, who wore them as loosely wrapped cloaks. Among the Indians in the mid-18th century, it was fashionable to wear match coats with woven belts, one of the few items of Native American manufacture that still formed part of Indian dress. Washington apparently belted his match coat, and in so doing, reinforced his physical resemblance to an Indian in the journal. Adorned in a match coat, Washington himself wears the mantle of the noble savage. On Thursday, the 27th, Washington and Gist entered a Delaware village with the ominous name of Murdering Town. Relating the events of that day, Washington told the story briefly in the journal. Gist wrote it up in great detail, complete with dialogue. After passing through Murdering Town, they met an Indian who called out to them, pretending friendship and offering to carry Washington's pack. The three continued together for 8 or 10 miles. The Indian also offered to carry his gun. Washington politely refused. Both Gist and Washington began to mistrust the man, whose behavior seemed increasingly erratic. Crossing a meadow, he got ahead of them in the woods, turned, leveled his musket, and fired. Having missed them both, he rushed behind a big white oak to reload. Before he could do so, they caught up with him. Gist was ready to shoot the man dead then and there, but Washington refused. During the Revolutionary War, Washington would establish a reputation for clemency among prisoners of war. Whereas the British army often gave no quarter, Washington refused to kill his captives and instead treated them humanely. The episode with the murdering town Indian shows that Washington's mercy in battle manifested itself long before the Revolutionary War. "As you will not have him killed," Gist privately said to Washington, "we must get him away, and then we must travel all night." Gist devised a clever scheme, pretending that they thought the Indian had fired solely to communicate his position to them. "I suppose you were lost and fired your gun," Gist said to him. The Indian readily agreed with Gist's seemingly innocent conclusion and assumed he still had their confidence. He assured them that his cabin was just a little further. "Well," Gist continued, "you go home, and as we are much tired, we will follow your track in the morning. And here is a cake of bread for you, and you must give us meat in the morning." Gist silently tracked him for a long way before doubling back to rejoin Washington, who made a small fire to guide Gist back through the darkness. After setting their compass by firelight, they resumed their trek, reaching the head of Piney Creek before daybreak. They continued hiking until dark the next day, when it was finally safe enough to sleep. On Saturday the 29th, they reached the Allegheny River. Since the rivers they had crossed recently had been frozen, they expected the Allegheny would be too, but it was only frozen partway across. The ice that had formed along the river banks increased the danger by constricting the river's flow and accelerating its current. To make the crossing more treacherous, ice from upriver had broken into blocks, which floated rapidly downstream. Whereas Washington had treated their run-in with the murdering town Indian briefly, he told the story of how they crossed the Allegheny in much greater detail. He clearly recognized the setting's dramatic potential. Developing this episode for the Journal, George Washington deserves credit for introducing the motif of the tension-filled wintertime river crossing to American literature. Harriet Beecher Stowe would effectively utilize this same motif when she had Eliza cross the Ohio River by stepping over big chunks of ice in Uncle Tom's Cabin, an episode the stage performances of the work seldom failed to dramatize. D.W. Griffith would reuse the motif, having Lillian Gish cross a rapid river filled with hunks of ice in Way Down East. Like Stowe and Griffith after him, Washington understood how a swiftly flowing, ice-filled river could create dramatic tension. Here's his version. "There was no way for getting over but on a raft, which we set about, with but one poor hatchet, and finished just after sunsetting. This was the whole day's work. We next got it launched and went on board of it, then set off. But before we were halfway over, we were jammed in the ice in such a manner that we expected every moment our raft to sink and ourselves to perish. I put out my setting pole to try to stop the raft, that the ice might pass by, when the rapidity of the stream threw it with such violence against the pole that it jerked me out into 10 feet of water, but I fortunately saved myself by catching hold of one of the raft logs. Notwithstanding all our efforts, we could not get the raft to either shore, but were obliged, as we were near an island, to quit our raft and make to it." Stranded on the island in the middle of the river, Washington and Gist went to bed with the knowledge that they would have to cross that dangerous river the next day, or die trying. But almost magically, a cold front moved in as they slept, dropping the temperature and freezing the rest of the river. They woke up and simply walked across. As they leave the wilderness on the way back to Williamsburg at the end of the journal, Washington gives readers one final image, a great one. "We met 17 horses loaded with materials and stores for a fort at the Forks of Ohio, and the day after some families going out to settle." Washington's image beautifully captures a crucial moment in American history. As he and Gist, the soldier and the trailblazer, return from the wilderness, they encounter pioneers venturing west to settle the land.